successful charting of a Venusian transit fell instead to a little-known Yorkshire-born sea captain named James Cook, who watched the 1769 transit from a sunny hilltop in Tahiti, and then went on to chart and claim Australia for the British Crown. Upon his return, there was now enough information for the French astronomer Joseph Lalande to calculate that the mean distance from the Earth to the Sun was a little over 150 million kilometres. Two further transits in the 19th century allowed astronomers to put the figure at 149.59 million kilometres, where it has remained ever since. The precise distance, we now know, is 149.59787061 million kilometres. The Earth at last had a position in space. As for Mason and Dixon, they returned to England as scientific heroes, and, for reasons unknown, dissolved their partnership. Considering the frequency with which they turn up at seminal events in 18th-century science, remarkably little is known about either man. No likenesses exist, and few written references. Of Dixon, the Dictionary of National Biography notes intriguingly that he was said to have been born in a coal mine, but then leaves it to the reader's imagination to supply a plausible explanatory circumstance, and adds that he died at Durham in 1777. Apart from his name and long association with Mason, nothing more is known. Mason is only slightly less shadowy. We know that in 1772, at Maskelyne's behest, he accepted the commission to find a suitable mountain for the gravitational deflection experiment, at length reporting back that the mountain they needed was in the central Scottish Highlands, just above Loch Tay, and was called Schiehallion. Nothing, however, would induce him to spend a summer surveying it. He never returned to the field again. His next known movement was in 1786, when, abruptly and mysteriously, he turned up in Philadelphia with his wife and 8 children, apparently on the verge of destitution. He had not been back to America since completing his survey there 18 years earlier, and had no known reason for being there, or any friends or patrons to greet him. A few weeks later, he was dead. With Mason refusing to survey the mountain, the job fell to Maskelyne. So for 4 months, in the summer of 1774, Maskelyne lived in a tent in a remote Scottish glen, and spent his days directing a team of surveyors, who took hundreds of measurements from every possible position. To find the mass of the mountain from all these numbers required a great deal of tedious calculating, for which a mathematician named Charles Hutton was engaged. The surveyors had covered a map with scores of figures, each marking an elevation at some point on or around the mountain. It was essentially just a confusing mass of numbers, but Hutton noticed that if he used a pencil to connect points of equal height, it all became much more orderly. Indeed, one could instantly get a sense of the overall shape and slope of the mountain. He had invented contour lines. Extrapolating from his Schiehallion measurements, Hutton calculated the mass of the Earth at 5,000,000,000,000 tons, from which could reasonably be deduced the masses of all the other major bodies in the solar system, including the Sun. So from this one experiment we learn the masses of the Earth, the Sun, the Moon, the other planets and their moons, and got contour lines into the bargain. Not bad for a summer's work. Not everyone was satisfied with the results, however. The shortcoming of the Schiehallion experiment was that it was not possible to get a truly accurate figure without knowing the actual density of the mountain. For convenience, Hutton had assumed that the mountain had the same density as ordinary stone, about 2.5 times that of water, but this was little more than an educated guess. One improbable-seeming person who turned his mind to the matter was a country parson named John Mitchell, who resided in the lonely Yorkshire village of Thornhill. Despite his remote and comparatively humble situation, Mitchell was one of the great scientific thinkers of the 18th century, and much esteemed for it. Among a great deal else, he perceived the wave-like nature of earthquakes, conducted much original research into magnetism and gravity, and quite extraordinarily envisioned the possibility of black holes, 200 years before anyone else, a leap of intuitive deduction that not even Newton could make. When the German-born musician William Herschel decided his real interest in life was astronomy, it was Mitchell to whom he turned for instruction in making telescopes, a kindness for which planetary science has been in his debt ever since. In 1781, Herschel became the first person in the modern era to discover a planet. He wanted to call it George, after the British monarch, but was overruled. Instead, it became Uranus. But of all that Mitchell accomplished, nothing was more ingenious or had greater impact than a machine he designed and built for measuring the mass of the Earth. Unfortunately, he died before he could conduct the experiments, and both the idea and the necessary equipment were passed on to a brilliant but magnificently retiring London scientist named Henry Cavendish. Cavendish is a book in himself. Born into a life of sumptuous privilege, his grandfathers were dukes, respectively, of Devonshire and Kent, he was the most gifted English scientist of his age, but also the strangest. He suffered, in the words of one of his few biographers, from shyness to a degree bordering on disease. Any human contact was for him a source of the deepest discomfort. Once he opened his door to find an Austrian admirer, freshly arrived from Vienna, on the front step. Excitedly, the Austrian began to babble out praise. For a few moments Cavendish received the compliments as if they were blows from a blunt object, and then, unable to take any more, fled down the path and out the gate, leaving the front door wide open. It was some hours before he could be coaxed back to the property. Even his housekeeper communicated with him by letter. Although he did sometimes venture into society, he was particularly devoted to the weekly scientific soirees of the great naturalist Sir Joseph Banks, it was always made clear to the other guests that Cavendish was on no account to be approached or even looked at. Those who sought his views were advised to wander into his vicinity as if by accident and to talk, as it were, into vacancy. If their remarks were scientifically worthy, they might receive a mumbled reply. But more often than not they would hear a peeved voice, his voice appears to have been high-pitched, and turn to find an actual vacancy, and the sight of Cavendish fleeing for a more peaceful corner. His wealth and solitary inclinations allowed him to turn his house in Clapham into a large laboratory, where he could range undisturbed through every corner of the physical sciences, electricity, heat, gravity, gases, anything to do with the composition of matter. The second half of the 18th century was a time when people of a scientific bent grew intensely interested in the physical properties of fundamental things, gases and electricity in particular, and began seeing what they could do with them, often with more enthusiasm than sense. In America, Benjamin Franklin famously risked his life by flying a kite in an electrical storm. In France, a chemist named Pilâtre de Rozier tested the flammability of hydrogen by gulping a mouthful and blowing across an open flame, proving, at a stroke, that hydrogen is indeed explosively combustible and that eyebrows are not necessarily a permanent feature of one's face. Cavendish, for his part, conducted experiments in which he subjected himself to graduated jolts of electrical current, diligently noting the increasing levels of agony until he could keep hold of his quill, and sometimes his consciousness, no longer. In the course of a long life, Cavendish made a string of signal discoveries. Among much else, he was the first person to isolate hydrogen, and the first to combine hydrogen and oxygen to form water. But almost nothing he did was entirely divorced from strangeness. To the continuing exasperation of his fellow scientists, he often alluded in published work to the results of contingent experiments that he had not told anyone about. In his secretiveness, he didn't merely resemble Newton, but actively exceeded him. His experiments with electrical conductivity were a century ahead of their time, but unfortunately remained undiscovered until that century had passed. Indeed, the greater part of what he did wasn't known until the late 19th century, when the Cambridge physicist James Clerk Maxwell took on the task of editing Cavendish's papers, by which time credit had nearly always been given to others. Among much else, and without telling anyone, Cavendish discovered or anticipated the law of the conservation of energy, Ohm's law, Dalton's law of partial pressures, Richter's law of reciprocal proportions, Charles's law of gases, and the principles of electrical conductivity. That's just some of it. According to the science historian J. G. Crowther, he also foreshadowed The Work of Kelvin and G. H. Darwin on the Effect of Tidal Friction on Slowing the Rotation of the Earth, and Lama's Discovery, published in 1915, on the Effect of Local Atmospheric Cooling, the work of Pickering on Freezing Mixtures, and some of the work of Roosboom on Heterogeneous Equilibria. Finally, he left clues that led directly to the discovery of the group of elements known as the noble gases, some of which are so elusive that the last of them wasn't found until 1962. But our interest here is in Cavendish's last known experiment, when, in the summer of 1797, at the age of 67, he turned his attention to the crates of equipment that had been left to him, evidently out of simple scientific respect, by John Mitchell. When assembled, Mitchell's apparatus looked like nothing so much as an 18th-century version of a Nautilus weight-training machine. It incorporated weights, counterweights, pendulums, shafts, and torsion wires. At the head of the machine were two 350-pound lead balls, which were suspended between two smaller spheres. The idea was to measure the gravitational deflection of the smaller spheres by the larger ones, which would allow the first measurement of the elusive force known as the gravitational constant, and from which the weight, strictly speaking the mass, of the Earth could be deduced. To a physicist, mass and weight are two quite different things. Your mass stays the same wherever you go, but your weight varies depending on how far you are from the center of some other massive object, like a planet. Travel to the moon, and you will be much lighter, but no less massive. On Earth, for all practical purposes, mass and weight are the same, and so the terms can be treated as synonymous, at least outside the classroom. Because gravity holds planets in orbit and makes falling objects land with a bang, we tend to think of it as a powerful force, but it is not really. It is only powerful in a kind of collective sense, when one massive object, like the Sun, holds on to another massive object, like the Earth. At an elemental level, gravity is extraordinarily unrobust. Each time you pick up a book from a table, or a dime from the floor, you effortlessly overcome the combined gravitational exertion of an entire planet. What Cavendish was trying to do was measure gravity at this extremely featherweight level. Delicacy was the key word. Not a whisper of disturbance could be allowed into the room containing the apparatus, so Cavendish took up a position in an adjoining room and made his observations with a telescope aimed through a peephole. The work was incredibly exacting, and involved 17 delicate, interconnected measurements, which together took nearly a year to complete. When, at last, he had finished his calculations, Cavendish announced that the Earth weighed a little over 6 billion trillion metric tons. A metric ton is 1,000 kilograms, or 2,205 pounds. Today, scientists have at their disposal machines so precise they can detect the weight of a single bacterium, and so sensitive that readings can be disturbed by someone yawning 75 feet away. But they have not significantly improved on Cavendish's measurement of 1797. The current best estimate for Earth's weight is 5.9725 billion trillion metric tons, a difference of only about 1% from Cavendish's finding. Interestingly, all of this merely confirmed estimates made by Newton 110 years before Cavendish, without any experimental evidence at all. So, by the late 18th century, scientists knew very precisely the shape and dimensions of the Earth, and its distance from the Sun and planets. And now Cavendish, without even leaving home, had given them its weight. So you might think that determining the age of the Earth would be relatively straightforward. After all, the necessary materials were literally at their feet. But no. Human beings would split the atom and invent television, nylon, and instant coffee before they could figure out the age of their own planet. To understand why, we must travel north to Scotland, and begin with a brilliant and genial man of whom few have ever heard, who had just invented a new science called geology. 5. The Stonebreakers. At just the time that Henry Cavendish was completing his experiments in London, 400 miles away, in Edinburgh, another kind of concluding moment was about to take place, with the death of James Hutton. This was bad news for Hutton, of course, but good news for science, as it cleared the way for a man named John Playfair to rewrite Hutton's work without fear of embarrassment. Hutton was, by all accounts, a man of the keenest insights and liveliest conversation, a delight in company, and without rival when it came to understanding the mysterious, slow processes that shaped the earth. Unfortunately, it was beyond him to set down his notions in a form that anyone could begin to understand. He was, as one biographer observed with an all but audible sigh, almost entirely innocent of rhetorical accomplishments. Nearly every line he penned was an invitation to slumber. Here he is in his 1795 masterwork, A Theory of the Earth with Proofs and Illustrations, discussing something. The world which we inhabit is composed of the materials, not of the earth which was the immediate predecessor of the present, but of the earth which, in ascending from the present, we consider as the third, and which had preceded the land that was above the surface of the sea, while our present land was yet beneath the water of the ocean. Yet almost single-handedly, and quite brilliantly, he created the science of geology, and transformed our understanding of the earth. Hutton was born in 1726 into a prosperous Scottish family, and enjoyed the sort of material comfort that allowed him to pass much of his life in a genially expansive round of light work and intellectual betterment. He studied medicine, but found it not to his liking, and turned instead to farming, which he followed in a relaxed and scientific way on the family estate in Berwickshire. Tiring of field and flock, in 1768 he moved to Edinburgh, where he founded a successful business producing sal ammoniac from coal soot, and busied himself with various scientific pursuits. Edinburgh at that time was a centre of intellectual vigour, and Hutton luxuriated in its enriching possibilities. He became a leading member of a society called the Oyster Club, where he passed his evenings in the company of men such as the economist Adam Smith, the chemist Joseph Black, and the philosopher David Hume, as well as such occasional visiting sparks as Benjamin Franklin and James Watt. In the tradition of the day, Hutton took an interest in nearly everything, from mineralogy to metaphysics. He conducted experiments with chemicals, investigated methods of coal mining and canal building, toured salt mines, speculated on the mechanisms of heredity, collected fossils, and propounded theories on rain, the composition of air, and the laws of motion, among much else. But his particular interest was geology. Among the questions that attracted interest in that fanatically inquisitive age was one that had puzzled people for a very long time. Namely, why ancient clamshells and other marine fossils were so often found on mountain tops. How on earth did they get there? Those who thought they had a solution fell into two opposing camps. One group, known as the Neptunists, was convinced that everything on earth, including seashells in improbably lofty places, could be explained by rising and falling sea levels. They believed that mountains, hills, and other features were as old as the earth itself, and were changed only when water sloshed over them during periods of global flooding. Opposing them were the Plutonists, who noted that volcanoes and earthquakes, among other enlivening agents, continually changed the face of the planet, but clearly owed nothing to wayward seas. The Plutonists also raised awkward questions about where all the water went when it wasn't in flood. If there was enough of it at times to cover the Alps, then where, pray, was it during times of tranquillity, such as now? Their belief was that the earth was subject to profound internal forces, as well as surface ones. However, they couldn't convincingly explain how all those clamshells got up there. It was while puzzling over these matters that Hutton had a series of exceptional insights. From looking at his own farmland, he could see that soil was created by the erosion of rocks, and that particles of this soil were continually washed away, and carried off by streams and rivers, and redeposited elsewhere. He realized that if such a process were carried to its natural conclusion, then earth would eventually be worn quite smooth. Yet everywhere around him there were hills. Certainly there had to be some additional process, some form of renewal and uplift that created new hills and mountains to keep the cycle going. The marine fossils on mountain tops, he decided, had not been deposited during floods, but had risen along with the mountains themselves. He also deduced that it was heat within the earth that created new rocks and continents and thrust up mountain chains. It is not too much to say that geologists wouldn't grasp the full implications of this thought for 200 years, when finally they adopted plate tectonics. Above all, what Hutton's theories suggested was that Earth processes required huge amounts of time, far more than anyone had ever dreamed. There were enough insights here to transform utterly our understanding of the Earth. In 1785, Hutton worked his ideas up into a long paper which was read at consecutive meetings of the Royal Society of Edinburgh. It attracted almost no notice at all. It's not hard to see why. Here, in part, is how he presented it to his audience. In the one case, the forming cause is in the body, which is separated, for after the body has been actuated by heat, it is by the reaction of the proper matter of the body that the chasm which constitutes the vein is formed. In the other case, again, the cause is extrinsic in relation to the body in which the chasm is formed. There has been the most violent fracture and divulsion. But the cause is still to seek, and it appears not in the vein, for it is not every fracture and dislocation of the solid body of our earth, in which minerals, or the proper substances of mineral veins, are found. Needless to say, almost no one in the audience had the faintest idea what he was talking about. Encouraged by his friends to expand his theory, in the touching hope that he might somehow stumble onto clarity in a more expansive format, Hutton spent the next 10 years preparing his magnum opus, which was published in 2 volumes in 1795. Together, the 2 books ran to nearly 1,000 pages, and were remarkably worse than even his most pessimistic friends had feared. Apart from anything else, nearly half the completed work now consisted of quotations from French sources, still in the original French. A 3rd volume was so unenticing that it wasn't published until 1899, more than a century after Hutton's death, and the 4th and concluding volume was never published at all. Hutton's Theory of the Earth is a strong candidate for the least read important book in science, or at least would be if there weren't so many others. Even Charles Lyell, the greatest geologist of the following century and a man who read everything, admitted he couldn't get through it. Luckily, Hutton had a Boswell in the form of John Playfair, a professor of mathematics at the University of Edinburgh and a close friend, who could not only write silken prose, but, thanks to many years at Hutton's elbow, actually understood what Hutton was trying to say, most of the time. In 1802, 5 years after Hutton's death, Playfair produced a simplified exposition of the Huttonian principles, entitled Illustrations of the Huttonian Theory of the Earth. The book was gratefully received by those who took an active interest in geology, which in 1802 was not a large number. That, however, was about to change. And how? In the winter of 1807, 13 like-minded souls in London got together at the Freemasons' Tavern at Longacre in Covent Garden to form a dining club to be called the Geological Society. The idea was to meet once a month to swap geological notions over a glass or two of Madeira and a convivial dinner. The price of the meal was set at a deliberately hefty 15 shillings to discourage those whose qualifications were merely cerebral. It soon became apparent, however, that there was a demand for something more properly institutional, with a permanent headquarters, where people could gather to share and discuss new findings. In barely a decade, membership grew to 400, still all gentlemen, of course, and the geological was threatening to eclipse the royal as the premier scientific society in the country. The members met twice a month, from November until June, when virtually all of them went off to spend the summer doing field work. These weren't people with a pecuniary interest in minerals, you understand, or even academics for the most part, but simply gentlemen with the wealth and time to indulge a hobby at a more or less professional level. By 1830, there were 745 of them, and the world would never see the like again. It is hard to imagine now, but geology excited the 19th century, positively gripped it, in a way that no science ever had before or would again. In 1839, when Roderick Murchison published The Silurian System, a plump and ponderous study of a type of rock called greywacke, it was an instant bestseller, racing through 4 editions, even though it cost 8 guineas a copy and was, in true Huttonian style, unreadable. As even a Murchison supporter conceded, it had a total want of literary attractiveness. And when, in 1841, the great Charles Lyell travelled to America to give a series of lectures in Boston, sell-out audiences of 3,000 at a time packed into the Lowell Institute to hear his tranquilizing descriptions of marine zeolites and seismic perturbations in Campania. Throughout the modern thinking world, but especially in Britain, men of learning ventured into the countryside to do a little stone-breaking, as they called it.
This book is continued on Disc 3. Disc 3.
Throughout the modern thinking world, but especially in Britain, men of learning ventured into the countryside to do a little stone-breaking, as they called it. It was a pursuit taken seriously, and they tended to dress with appropriate gravity, in top hats and dark suits, except for the Reverend William Buckland of Oxford, whose habit it was to do his field work in an academic gown. The field attracted many extraordinary figures, not least the aforementioned Murchison, who spent the first 30 or so years of his life galloping after foxes, converting aeronautically challenged birds into puffs of drifting feathers with buckshot, and showing no mental agility whatever, beyond that needed to read the Times or play a hand of cards. Then he discovered an interest in rocks, and became, with rather astounding swiftness, a titan of geological thinking. Then there was Dr. James Parkinson, who was also an early socialist and author of many provocative pamphlets with titles like Revolution Without Bloodshed. In 1794 he was implicated in a faintly lunatic-sounding conspiracy called the Popgun Plot, in which it was planned to shoot King George III in the neck with a poisoned dart as he sat in his box at the theatre. Parkinson was hauled before the Privy Council for questioning, and came within an ace of being dispatched in irons to Australia, before the charges against him were quietly dropped. Adopting a more conservative approach to life, he developed an interest in geology, and became one of the founding members of the Geological Society, and the author of an important geological text, Organic Remains of a Former World, which remained in print for half a century. He never caused trouble again. Today, however, we remember him for his landmark study of the affliction then called the shaking palsy, but known ever since as Parkinson's disease. Parkinson had one other slight claim to fame. In 1785 he became possibly the only person in history to win a natural history museum in a raffle. The museum, in London's Leicester Square, had been founded by Sir Ashton Lever, who had driven himself bankrupt with his unrestrained collecting of natural wonders. Parkinson kept the museum until 1805, when he could no longer support it, and the collection was broken up and sold. Not quite as remarkable in character, but more influential than all the others combined, was Charles Lyell. Lyell was born in the year that Hutton died, and only 70 miles away in the village of Kinnordy. Though Scottish by birth, he grew up in the far south of England, in the New Forest of Hampshire, because his mother was convinced that Scots were feckless drunks. As was generally the pattern with 19th-century gentleman scientists, Lyell came from a background of comfortable wealth and intellectual vigour. His father, also named Charles, had the unusual distinction of being a leading authority on the poet Dante and on mosses. Orthotricium Lyelli, which most visitors to the English countryside will at some time have sat on, is named for him. From his father, Lyell gained an interest in natural history, but it was at Oxford, where he fell under the spell of the Reverend William Buckland, he of the flowing gowns, that the young Lyell began his lifelong devotion to geology. Buckland was a bit of a charming oddity. He had some real achievements, but he is remembered at least as much for his eccentricities. He was particularly noted for a menagerie of wild animals, some large and dangerous, that were allowed to roam through his house and garden, and for his desire to eat his way through every animal in creation. Depending on whim and availability, guests to Buckland's house might be served baked guinea pig, mice in batter, roasted hedgehog, or boiled Southeast Asian sea slug. Buckland was able to find merit in them all, except the common garden mole, which he declared disgusting. Almost inevitably he became the leading authority on coprolites, fossilized feces, and had a table made entirely out of his collection of specimens. Even when conducting serious science, his manner was generally singular. Once Mrs. Buckland found herself being shaken awake in the middle of the night, her husband crying in excitement, "My dear, I believe that Cheirotherium's footsteps are undoubtedly testudinal." Together they hurried to the kitchen in the nightclothes. Mrs. Buckland made a flour paste, which she spread across the table, while the Reverend Buckland fetched the family tortoise. Plunking it onto the paste, they goaded it forward, and discovered to their delight that its footprints did indeed match those of the fossil Buckland had been studying. Charles Darwin thought Buckland a buffoon. That was the word he used. But Lyell appeared to find him inspiring, and liked him well enough to go touring with him in Scotland in 1824. It was soon after this trip that Lyell decided to abandon a career in law and devote himself to geology full-time. Lyell was extremely short-sighted, and went through most of his life with a pained squint which gave him a troubled air. Eventually he would lose his sight altogether. His other slight peculiarity was the habit, when distracted by thought, of taking up improbable positions on furniture, lying across two chairs at once, or resting his head on the seat of a chair while standing up, to quote his friend Darwin. Often when lost in thought, he would slink so low in a chair that his buttocks would all but touch the floor. Lyell's only real job in life was as Professor of Geology at King's College in London from 1831 to 1833. It was around this time that he produced The Principles of Geology, published in three volumes between 1830 and 1833, which in many ways consolidated and elaborated upon the thoughts first voiced by Hutton a generation earlier. Although Lyell never read Hutton in the original, he was a keen student of Playfair's reworked version. Between Hutton's day and Lyell's, there arose a new geological controversy, which largely superseded, but is often confused with, the old Neptunian-Plutonian dispute. The new battle became an argument between catastrophism and uniformitarianism, unattractive terms for an important and very long-running dispute. Catastrophists, as you might expect from the name, believed that the earth was shaped by abrupt cataclysmic events, floods principally, which is why catastrophism and Neptunism are often wrongly bundled together. Catastrophism was particularly comforting to clerics like Buckland, because it allowed them to incorporate the biblical flood of Noah into serious scientific discussions. Uniformitarians, by contrast, believed that changes on earth were gradual, and that nearly all earth processes happened slowly, over immense spans of time. Hutton was much more the father of the notion than Lyell, but it was Lyell most people read, and so he became, in most people's minds, then and now, the father of modern geological thought. Lyell believed that the earth's shifts were uniform and steady, that everything that had ever happened in the past could be explained by events still going on today. Lyell and his adherents didn't just disdain catastrophism, they detested it. Catastrophists believed that extinctions were part of a series in which animals were repeatedly wiped out and replaced with new sets, a belief that the naturalist T. H. Huxley mockingly likened to a succession of rubbers of whist, at the end of which the players upset the table and called for a new pack. It was too convenient a way to explain the unknown. Never was there a dogma more calculated to foster indolence and to blunt the keen edge of curiosity, sniffed Lyell. Lyell's oversights were not inconsiderable. He failed to explain convincingly how mountain ranges were formed and overlooked glaciers as an agent of change. He refused to accept Louis Agassiz's idea of ice ages, the refrigeration of the globe, as he dismissively termed it, and was confident that mammals would be found in the oldest fossiliferous beds. He rejected the notion that animals and plants suffered sudden annihilations, and believed that all the principal animal groups, mammals, reptiles, fish, and so on, had coexisted since the dawn of time. On all of these he would ultimately be proved wrong. Yet it would be nearly impossible to overstate Lyell's influence. The Principles of Geology went through 12 editions in Lyell's lifetime, and contained notions that shaped geological thinking far into the 20th century. Darwin took a first edition with him on the Beagle voyage, and wrote afterward that the great merit of the Principles was that it altered the whole tone of one's mind, and therefore that, when seeing a thing never seen by Lyell, one yet saw it partially through his eyes. In short, he thought him nearly a god, as did many of his generation. It is a testament to the strength of Lyell's sway that in the 1980s, when geologists had to abandon just a part of it to accommodate the impact theory of extinctions, it nearly killed them. But that is another chapter. Meanwhile, geology had a great deal of sorting out to do, and not all of it went smoothly. From the outset, geologists tried to categorize rocks by the periods in which they were laid down, but there were often bitter disagreements about where to put the dividing lines, none more so than a long-running debate that became known as the Great Devonian Controversy. The issue arose when the Reverend Adam Sedgwick of Cambridge claimed for the Cambrian period a layer of rock that Roderick Murchison believed belonged rightly to the Silurian. The dispute raged for years, and grew extremely heated. "De la Beche is a dirty dog," Murchison wrote to a friend in a typical outburst. Some sense of the strength of feeling can be gained by glancing through the chapter titles of Martin J. S. Rudwick's excellent and sombre account of the issue, The Great Devonian Controversy. These begin innocuously enough with headings such as Arenas of Gentlemanly Debate and Unravelling the Greywacker, but then proceed on to The Greywacker Defended and Attacked, Reproofs and Recriminations, The Spread of Ugly Rumours, Weaver Recants His Heresy, Putting a Provincial in His Place, and, in case there was any doubt that this was war, Murchison Opens the Rhineland Campaign. The fight was finally settled in 1879, with the simple expedient of coming up with a new period, the Ordovician, to be inserted between the two. Because the British were the most active in the early years, British names are predominant in geological lexicon. Devonian is, of course, from the English county of Devon. Cambrian comes from the Roman name for Wales, while Ordovician and Silurian recall ancient Welsh tribes, the Ordovices and Silures. But with the rise of geological prospecting elsewhere, names began to creep in from all over. Jurassic refers to the Jura Mountains on the border of France and Switzerland. Permian recalls the former Russian province of Perm in the Ural Mountains. For Cretaceous, from the Latin for chalk, we are indebted to a Belgian geologist with a perky name of J.J. Domalius Daloy. Originally, geological history was divided into four spans of time: primary, secondary, tertiary, and quaternary. The system was too neat to last, and soon geologists were contributing additional divisions while eliminating others. Primary and secondary fell out of use altogether, while quaternary was discarded by some but kept by others. Today only tertiary remains as a common designation everywhere, even though it no longer represents a third period of anything. Lyell, in his Principles, introduced additional units known as epochs or series to cover the period since the age of the dinosaurs, among them Pleistocene, most recent, Pliocene, more recent, Miocene, moderately recent, and the rather endearingly vague Oligocene, but a little recent. Lyell originally intended to employ synchronous for his endings, giving us such crunchy designations as miosynchronous and pliosynchronous. The Reverend William Hewell, an influential man, objected on etymological grounds and suggested instead an eos pattern, producing myonius, pionius, and so on. The scene terminations were thus something of a compromise. Nowadays, and speaking very generally, geological time is divided first into four great chunks known as eras: Precambrian, Paleozoic, from the Greek meaning old life, Mesozoic, middle life, and Cenozoic, recent life. These four eras are further divided into anywhere from a dozen to 20 subgroups, usually called periods, though sometimes known as systems. Most of these are also reasonably well known: Cretaceous, Jurassic, Triassic, Silurian, and so on. There will be no testing here, but if you are ever required to memorize them, you might wish to remember John Wilford's helpful advice to think of the eras, Precambrian, Paleozoic, Mesozoic, and Cenozoic, as seasons in a year, and the periods, Permian, Triassic, Jurassic, etc., as the months. Then come Lyell's epochs, the Pleistocene, Miocene, and so on, which apply only to the most recent, but paleontologically busy, 65 million years. And finally, we have a mass of finer subdivisions known as stages, or ages. Most of these are named nearly always awkwardly after places: Illinoian, Des Moinesian, Quaxian, Kimmeridgian, and so on, in like vein. Altogether, according to John McPhee, these number in the tens of dozens. Fortunately, unless you take up geology as a career, you are unlikely ever to hear any of them again. Further confusing the matter is that the stages or ages in North America have different names from the stages in Europe, and often only roughly intersect in time. Thus the North American Cincinnatian stage mostly corresponds with the Ashgillian stage in Europe, plus a tiny bit of the slightly earlier Caradocian stage. Also, all this changes from textbook to textbook, and from person to person, so that some authorities describe seven recent epochs, while others are content with four. In some books, too, you will find the tertiary and quaternary taken out and replaced by periods of different lengths, called the Paleogene and Neogene. Others divide the Precambrian into two eras, the very ancient Archean and the more recent Proterozoic. Sometimes, too, you will see the term Phanerozoic used to describe the span encompassing the Cenozoic, Mesozoic, and Paleozoic eras. Moreover, all this applies only to units of time. Rocks are divided into quite separate units, known as systems, series, and stages. A distinction is also made between late and early, referring to time, and upper and lower, referring to layers of rock. It can all get terribly confusing to non-specialists, but to a geologist these can be matters of passion. I have seen grown men glow incandescent with rage over this metaphorical millisecond in life's history, the British paleontologist Richard Forte has written, with regard to a long-running 20th-century dispute over where the boundary lies between the Cambrian and the Ordovician. At least today we can bring some sophisticated dating techniques to the table. For most of the 19th century, geologists could draw on nothing more than the most hopeful guesswork. The frustrating position then was that although they could place the various rocks and fossils in order by age, they had no idea how long any of those ages were. When Buckland speculated on the antiquity of Nycthiosaurus' skeleton, he could do no better than suggest that it had lived somewhere between 10,000 or more than 10,000 times 10,000 years earlier. Although there was no reliable way of dating periods, there was no shortage of people willing to try. The most well-known early attempt was in 1650, when Archbishop James Usher of the Church of Ireland made a careful study of the Bible and other historical sources, and concluded, in a hefty tome called Annals of the Old Testament, that the earth had been created at midday on October the 23rd, 4004 B.C., an assertion that has amused historians and textbook writers ever since. Although virtually all books find a space for him, there is a striking variability in the details associated with Usher. Some books say he made his pronouncement in 1650, others in 1654, still others in 1664. Many cite the date of Earth's reputed beginning as October the 26th. The matter is interestingly surveyed in Stephen Jay Gould's Eight Little Piggies. There is a persistent myth, incidentally, and one propounded in many serious books, that Usher's views dominated scientific beliefs well into the 19th century, and that it was Lyell who put everyone straight. Stephen Jay Gould, in Time's Arrow, cites as a typical example this sentence from a popular book of the 1980s. Until Lyell published his book, most thinking people accepted the idea that the Earth was young. In fact, no. As Martin J.S. Rudwick puts it, no geologist of any nationality whose work was taken seriously by other geologists advocated a timescale confined within the limits of a literalistic exegesis of Genesis. Even the Reverend Buckland, as pious a soul as the 19th century produced, noted that nowhere did the Bible suggest that God made heaven and earth on the first day, but merely in the beginning. That beginning, he reasoned, may have lasted millions upon millions of years. Everyone agreed that the earth was ancient. The question was simply how ancient. One of the better early attempts at dating the planet came from the ever-reliable Edmund Halley, who in 1715 suggested that if you divided the total amount of salt in the world's seas by the amount added each year, you would get the number of years that the oceans had been in existence, which would give you a rough idea of Earth's age. The logic was appealing, but unfortunately no one knew how much salt was in the sea or by how much it increased every year, which rendered the experiment impracticable. The first attempt at measurement that could be called remotely scientific was made by the Frenchman Georges-Louis Leclerc, Comte de Buffon, in the 1770s. It had long been known that the Earth radiated appreciable amounts of heat. That was apparent to anyone who went down a coal mine. But there wasn't any way of estimating the rate of dissipation. Buffon's experiment consisted of heating spheres until they glowed white-hot, and then estimating the rate of heat loss by touching them, presumably very lightly at first, as they cooled. From this he guessed the Earth's age to be somewhere between 75,000 and 168,000 years old. This was, of course, a wild underestimate, but a radical notion nonetheless, and Buffon found himself threatened with excommunication for expressing it. A practical man, he apologized at once for his thoughtless heresy, then cheerfully repeated the assertions throughout his subsequent writings. By the middle of the 19th century, most learned people thought the Earth was at least a few million years old, perhaps even some tens of millions of years old, but probably not more than that. So it came as a surprise when, in 1859, in On the Origin of Species, Charles Darwin announced that the geological processes that created the Weald, an area of southern England stretching across Kent, Surrey, and Sussex, had taken, by his calculations, 306,662,400 years to complete. The assertion was remarkable, partly for being so arrestingly specific, but even more for flying in the face of accepted wisdom about the age of the Earth. Darwin loved an exact number. In a later work he announced that the number of worms to be found in an average acre of English country soil was 53,767. It proved so contentious that Darwin withdrew it from the third edition of the book. The problem at its heart remained, however. Darwin and his geological friends needed the Earth to be old, but no one could figure out a way to make it so. Unfortunately for Darwin, and for progress, the question came to the attention of the great Lord Kelvin, who, though indubitably great, was then still just plain William Thomson. He wouldn't be elevated to the peerage until 1892, when he was 68 years old and nearing the end of his career, but I shall follow the convention here of using the name retroactively. Kelvin was one of the most extraordinary figures of the 19th century, indeed of any century. The German scientist Hermann von Helmholtz, no intellectual slouch himself, wrote that Kelvin had by far the greatest intelligence and lucidity and mobility of thought of any man he had ever met. "I felt quite wooden beside him sometimes," he added, a bit dejectedly. The sentiment is understandable, for Kelvin really was a kind of Victorian Superman. He was born in 1824 in Belfast, the son of a professor of mathematics at the Royal Academical Institution, who soon after transferred to Glasgow. There Kelvin proved himself such a prodigy that he was admitted to Glasgow University at the exceedingly tender age of 10. By the time he had reached his early 20s, he had studied at institutions in London and Paris, graduated from Cambridge, where he won the university's top prizes for rowing and mathematics, and somehow found time to launch a musical society as well, been elected a Fellow of Peterhouse, and written, in French and English, a dozen papers in pure and applied mathematics, of such dazzling originality that he had to publish them anonymously for fear of embarrassing his superiors. At the age of 22, he returned to Glasgow University to take up a professorship in natural philosophy, a position he would hold for the next 53 years. In the course of a long career, he lived till 1907, and the age of 83, he wrote 661 papers, accumulated 69 patents, from which he grew abundantly wealthy, and gained renown in nearly every branch of the physical sciences. Among much else, he suggested the method that led directly to the invention of refrigeration, devised the scale of absolute temperature that still bears his name, invented the boosting devices that allowed telegrams to be sent across oceans, and made innumerable improvements to shipping and navigation, from the invention of a popular marine compass to the creation of the first depth sounder. And those were merely his practical achievements. His theoretical work in electromagnetism, thermodynamics, and the wave theory of light was equally revolutionary. In particular, he elaborated the second law of thermodynamics. A discussion of these laws would be a book in itself, but I offer here this crisp summation by the chemist P. W. Atkins, just to provide a sense of them. There are four laws. The third of them, the second law, was recognized first. The first, the zeroth law, was formulated last. The first law was second. The third law might not even be a law in the same sense of the others. In briefest terms, the second law states that a little energy is always wasted. You can't have a perpetual motion device because no matter how efficient, it will always lose energy and eventually run down. The first law says that you can't create energy, and the third that you can't reduce temperatures to absolute zero. There will always be some residual warmth. As Dennis Overby notes, the three principal laws are sometimes expressed jocularly as 1. You can't win, 2. You can't break even, and 3. You can't get out of the game. He had really only one flaw, and that was an inability to calculate the correct age of the earth. The question occupied much of the second half of his career, but he never came anywhere near getting it right. His first effort in 1862 for an article in a popular magazine called Macmillan's suggested that the earth was 98 million years old, but cautiously allowed that the figure could be as low as 20 million years or as high as 400 million. With remarkable prudence, he acknowledged that his calculations could be wrong if sources now unknown to us are prepared in the great storehouse of creation. But it was clear that he thought that unlikely. With the passage of time, Kelvin would become more forthright in his assertions and less correct. He continually revised his estimates downward, from a maximum of 400 million years to 100 million years to 50 million years, and finally, in 1897, to a mere 24 million years. Kelvin wasn't being willful. It was simply that there was nothing in physics that could explain how a body the size of the sun could burn continuously for more than a few tens of millions of years at most without exhausting its fuel. Therefore it followed that the sun and its planets were relatively, but inescapably, youthful. The problem was that nearly all the fossil evidence contradicted this, and suddenly, in the 19th century, there was a lot of fossil evidence. 6. Science Red in Tooth and Claw. In 1787, someone in New Jersey, exactly who now seems to be forgotten, found an enormous thigh bone sticking out of a stream bank at a place called Woodbury Creek. The bone clearly didn't belong to any species of creature still alive, certainly not in New Jersey. From what little is known now, it is thought to have belonged to a hadrosaur, a large duck-billed dinosaur. At the time, dinosaurs were unknown. The bone was sent to Dr. Caspar Wister, the nation's leading anatomist, who described it at a meeting of the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia that autumn. Unfortunately, Wistar failed completely to recognize the bone's significance, and merely made a few cautious and uninspired remarks to the effect that it was indeed a whopper. He thus missed the chance, half a century ahead of anyone else, to be the discoverer of dinosaurs. Indeed, the bone excited so little interest that it was put in a storeroom, and eventually disappeared altogether. So the first dinosaur bone ever found was also the first to be lost. That the bone didn't attract greater interest is more than a little puzzling, for its appearance came at a time when America was in a froth of excitement about the remains of large, ancient animals. The cause of this froth was a strange assertion by the great French naturalist, the Comte de Buffon, he of the heated spheres from the previous chapter, that living things in the New World were inferior in nearly every way to those of the Old World. America, Buffon wrote in his vast and much-esteemed Histoire Naturelle, was a land where the water was stagnant, the soil unproductive, and the animals without size or vigour, their constitutions weakened by the noxious vapours that rose from its rotting swamps and sunless forests. In such an environment even the native Indians lacked virility. They have no beard or body hair, Buffon sagely confided, and no ardour for the female. Their reproductive organs were small and feeble. Buffon's observations found surprisingly eager support among other writers, especially those whose conclusions were not complicated by actual familiarity with the country. A Dutchman named Comte de Pau announced in a popular work called Recherche philosophique sur les Américains that Native American males were not only reproductively unimposing, but so lacking in virility that they had milk in their breasts. Such views enjoyed an improbable durability, and could be found repeated or echoed in European texts till near the end of the 19th century. Not surprisingly, such aspersions were indignantly met in America. Thomas Jefferson incorporated a furious, and, unless the context is understood, quite bewildering, rebuttal in his Notes on the State of Virginia, and induced his New Hampshire friend, General John Sullivan, to send 20 soldiers into the northern woods to find a bull moose to present to Buffon as proof of the stature and majesty of American quadrupeds. It took the men 2 weeks to track down a suitable subject. The moose, when shot, unfortunately lacked the imposing horns that Jefferson had specified, but Sullivan thoughtfully included a rack of antlers from an elk or stag, with a suggestion that these be attached instead. Who in France, after all, would know? Meanwhile, in Philadelphia, Wistar's city, naturalists had begun to assemble the bones of a giant elephant-like creature known at first as the Great American Incognitum, but later identified, not quite correctly, as a mammoth. The first of these bones had been discovered at a place called Big Bone Lick in Kentucky, but soon others were turning up all over. America, it appeared, had once been the home of a truly substantial creature, one that would surely disprove Buffon's foolish Gallic contentions. In their keenness to demonstrate the incognitum's bulk and ferocity, the American naturalists appear to have become slightly carried away. They overestimated its size by a factor of 6, and gave it frightening claws, which in fact came from a megalonyx, or giant ground sloth, found nearby. Rather remarkably, they persuaded themselves that the animal had enjoyed the agility and ferocity of the tiger, and portrayed it in illustrations as pouncing with feline grace onto prey from boulders. When tusks were discovered, they were forced into the animal's head in any number of inventive ways. One restorer screwed the tusks in upside down, like the fangs of a saber-toothed cat, which gave it a satisfyingly aggressive aspect. Another arranged the tusks so that they curved backwards, on the engaging theory that the creature had been aquatic, and had used them to anchor itself to trees while dozing. The most pertinent consideration about the incognitum, however, was that it appeared to be extinct, a fact that Buffon cheerfully seized upon as proof of its incontestably degenerate nature. Buffon died in 1788, but the controversy rolled on. In 1795, a selection of bones made their way to Paris, where they were examined by the rising star of paleontology, the youthful and aristocratic Georges Cuvier. Cuvier was already dazzling people with his genius for taking heaps of disarticulated bones and whipping them into shapely forms. It was said that he could describe the look and nature of an animal from a single tooth or scrap of jaw, and often name the species and genus into the bargain. Realizing that no one in America had thought to write a formal description of the lumbering beast, Cuvier did so, and thus became its official discoverer. He called it a mastodon, which means, a touch unexpectedly, nipple teeth. Inspired by the controversy, in 1796 Cuvier wrote a landmark paper, Note on the Species of Living and Fossil Elephants, in which he put forward for the first time a formal theory of extinctions. His belief was that from time to time the Earth experienced global catastrophes in which groups of creatures were wiped out. For religious people, including Cuvier himself, the idea raised uncomfortable implications, since it suggested an unaccountable casualness on the part of Providence. To what end would God create species only to wipe them out later? The notion was contrary to the belief in the great chain of being, which held that the world was carefully ordered, and that every living thing within it had a place and purpose, and always had, and always would.